Jersey. Hello, New Jersey. Hello, New Jersey. It's so good to be here. While you're standing, would you grab somebody's hand? Those on the audio, just bring this up a little bit. I've been running, and I'll back off if necessary. God, we come now holding hands as you hold us. We come with no delusions. We know that whenever you call men and women to declare your word, you take the risk of putting treasure in trash. Treasure in earthen, sometimes failing, frail vessels. But you do it that the excellency of the power might be of thee and not of us. So hide us behind the cross, cover us in your blood, fill us with your spirit. We ask it in your great name. Amen. It's good to be. Hello, that better? All right. It's so good. Let's give it a hand for this church and this pastor who's been so kind. And there is a sister. I want you all to give a hand because I have just about worried her until her hair has turned blue. Where is she at? Let me find her in here. It's been tough getting around, moving around. There she is. Y'all stand up, Sister Bay. She had a full head of hair until she started messing with me. Y'all give her a hand. One of the baddest organizers this side of heaven. Amen. Amen. I thank God for Sister Ernestine. You going to heaven if you put up with me. That's what they tell my wife, the same thing. It's good to be here with all of my brothers and sisters and ministry and all of my friends. Coming here tonight, Pastor, I'm often wondering, I get invitations to come, and sometimes I'll say, wonder, why they invited me. Church in Trenton, you got folks sitting all up, I'm a country preacher, folks sitting all up there, got a full band to my right, got more than one microphone, my church is... That one goes out, you just got to holler. Got police, unionized police. Had strawberries down in the bottom. And already had three sermons. Had a Jewish sermon, an AME sermon, and a non-denominational sermon. Wonder why in the world. Then I thought about it. I understand what y'all doing. Y'all ain't slick. It's like the guy that entered his mule in the Kentucky Derby. Those swayback mules. Seeing y'all from the country. How many of y'all ain't been in the city all your life? Don't sit up here and fake the funk now. Come on. Some of y'all got some cousins back down south. And so they had a mule, for the young folk don't know a mule, and he had a sway back, and they put him in the Kentucky Derby. And one of the guys said, why are you putting that sway back mule in the Kentucky Derby with all those thoroughbreds? He said, before he gets out of the gate, they'll be finished the race. He said, I know that. He said, well, why would you pay $10,000 entry fee to put a swayback mule, Sister Gerald, in the race, and you know he's not going to win? He said, I know he's not going to win, but I put him in there because I thought the exposure might do him some good. Well, that's why, Sister, you getting me back tonight, Sister Baker. You put me behind all these great preachers because she thought the exposure might do me some good. But it's good to be in the house tonight. I want to take my time tonight and suggest an analysis of where we are, if you're serious about building a resistance, you got to know what you're resisting. And you don't know just because you look at CNN. It might be a little bit deeper than you think. And so you got to take some time. The Bible said if you're going to build a tower, you got to first consider the cost. There is a scripture, if my mind serves me well, in the 3rd chapter of Daniel, where the king and his compadres were trying to get some people to bow. And they said, these boys said, King, we don't have to answer you. There really is no question about whether our God can save us. But even if he doesn't, we will not bow. I want to come back to that. I want to come back and talk about standing down or bowing down is not an option. But before I get there, I just want to talk for a minute. I want to turn this into a class on public theology and activism. New Jersey, where you have one of the greatest and most compassionate governors in the country. New Jersey. You know, I'm part of my heritage is black. I'm black, Tuscarora Indian, and white. So the black side just told me to speak in, you know, the slaves spoke in code language. They said one thing and meant another. Y'all with me? New Jersey. Where you have almost 11% of all of your people in poverty. New Jersey. Where 15% of your children are in poverty, New Jersey. Where 20% of African Americans, 1 out of 5, live below the poverty line. Now, understand, don't make the mistake and think that above the poverty line, you aren't poor. You just aren't poor according to the government's rating. New Jersey. 20% of Latinos poor. New Jersey. 42nd in income inequality, where the top 20% of the households and the share of income going to the bottom 20, there's a big gap. New Jersey. We have 13% of disconnected youth between the ages of 18 and 24 who are not in school, not working. Y'all had some problems before Bridgegate. And I'm here tonight as president and senior lecturer of repairs of the breach. I'm president of NAACP, but tonight I'm here as a pastor and president of repairs of the breach. Say some things. New Jersey, where women make 80.4 cents for every dollar men make, but the women probably give 90% of the tithes in the churches. And they're giving those tithes in churches for a whole lot of pastors who are riding their Cadillac but won't get out and fight for the people. Oh, excuse me, I'm sorry. New Jersey. So if that's already going on, this was, I'm going to be part country and part erudite. I went to Drew, you know, I taught at Princeton. I know how to do that stuff. But if that were already going on, faux Trump, then you have a problem deeper than Trump. If people were already staying stuck in their synagogues and their mosques and their churches, and it took Trump to get elected to get you out, your theology is still wrong, because all of this existed . But the question becomes, then, if that was already happening, what do you do when a presidential election inaugurates at the highest level racism, lies, greed, and arrogance? First, you have to understand how we got here. Oliver Mundy and Kevin Baker wrote a little article about this election on Inauguration Day, and it went like this. It says, "I'm not over it. I know Mr. Trump was elected in part, because too many people were still hurting in this economy from the terrible disruptions of their lives and their communities over the last 25 years. Then the author says, but I've been poor, I've been desperate myself, I know what it feels like, yet that is no excuse for what we did last November. Throughout our history, Americans have encountered economic shocks much worse than anything we know today, and with many fewer resources at their disposal. American working people have agency. They are plenty educated, and in past crises, they still rejected the extremism that other nations turned to, even in the Great Depression. Most Americans did not succumb to the ideologies of fascism and communism sweeping the world. Today's passive, unhappy Americans sat on their couches and chose a strutting TV clown to save us. Now, some of them that didn't vote in here, so I'm just going to tell you that. Got to be. 97 million people didn't vote. He goes on to say, what they have done is a desecration, a foolish and vindictive act of vandalism by which they betrayed all the best and the most valiant labors of our ancestors. We don't want to accept this, because we cannot accept that people, at least in the long run of things, can be wrong in our American democracy, but we can be wrong in America, just like any other people anywhere else. And until we do accept this as an abject failure of both our systems and ourselves, there is no hope for our redemption. Now, though, I want to disagree with the author a little bit, because he says Americans didn't do this in the past. I want to say, that's true. This ain't the first time. And this ain't the worst thing, because to say this is the worst thing we've ever faced is to overlook Jim Crow slavery and the Holocaust. So don't. You know, you even have to be careful how you identify your adversary, so you don't see yourself as grasshopper and your adversary as a giant. You got to be careful. But this not the first time. Can I teach? I'm just, if you want to have a resistance movement. In the shadow of slavery and amid the wreckage of the Civil War, something happened in America called Reconstruction. African Americans, former slaves, joined hands with whites in the North and poor whites in the South, who figured out that the Civil War was about wealthy plantation owners and not about poor whites. And they became allies, and they formed something called Fusion Coalition, not just coalition, but fusion coalitions where they saw the intersectionality and the interlocking reality of their existence. And within 4 years after the end of the Civil War, white and black alliances controlled every state house in the South, from Virginia to Texas. Many of them had been former slaves. And they, in those new southern legislatures, they hammered out new constitutions from a deeply moral perspective, not Democrat, Republican, deeply moral, and they forced the nation to hammer out federal changes like the 13th Amendment ending slavery, and the 14th Amendment, equal protection under the law for all people, and the 15th Amendment that guarantees the right to vote regardless of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. And later on, the fusion moral model would also hammer out the 19th Amendment, which gave women the right to vote. Never forget, it was Sojourner Truth and Elizabeth Cady Stanton together. These fusion coalitions of about 150 some years ago, they built the first public schools. And they wrote state constitutions where education was guaranteed to all people. They gave people the right to vote. They raised taxes so that the government could have the resources to correct the problems that government created. Government created slavery. Government created disparity. So they understood government had to uncreate. But within 4 years, by 1872, this started 1868, by 1872, the Reconstruction movement faced powerful and immoral opposition. There were people in the North and in the South who saw black citizenship and interracial alliances that had power. They didn't mind black and white folk going to church together, but when black and white folks started hooking up and going to the state house together, they saw that as inherently illegitimate. So they organized the Klan to terrorize white people. Uh-oh. The first work toward the Klan was not at black people. It was to terrorize whites in the South and northern whites who were coming down working with African Americans and Jewish brothers and sisters who were in the country. These extremists also began to call for cutting taxes. They wanted to cut taxes so that the government could not do what the government should do to undo what the government had done. They hated public education for everyone. They wanted to keep these fusion coalitions from expanding opportunity and enlarging democracy. They couldn't deny the vote outright, so they decided to abridge the vote, and they started putting in place things that didn't sound racist, like poll taxes and literacy tests and grandfather clauses. And they deliberately went after the courts and started putting in the courts extremists judges. And then in 1877, they had an election. And they elected, well, no, they didn't. Let me correct that. They had a selection. Rutherford B. Hayes lost the popular vote. He lost the popular vote. But he went to the races in the country and said, if you will give me the Electoral College, even though I lost the popular vote, I will then turn over the South back to the races, and began to get rid not only of the African Americans in the legislature in the South and those progressive whites, but in the Congress. And they did, and he did. began to reappoint people to the Supreme Court and judges. And by 1883, you only had one progressive judge. His name was Justice Harlan from Kentucky. They called him the Great Dissenter. And in 1883, the courts overturned the 1875 Civil Rights Act. The 1875 Civil Rights Act made it a felony to sexually discriminate in wages, schools. By 1883, it's gone. 6 years. Justice Harlan was the only person, the all-white Supreme Court, he was the only one to dissent. It was over. 1896, Plessy versus Ferguson. All the justices voted that separate but equal was constitutional, except Justice Harlan. And undergirding all of this, they had a group of preachers and others that called themselves the Redemption Movement. Now that sounds real religious. We're in the Redemption Movement. But in the 1800s of Deconstruction, redemption, they talked about private salvation and personal sin and not social sin and social injustice. And what they wanted to redeem was they wanted to redeem America from the sin of progress. And that meant they had to redeem America from the sin of black and white people working together. Because if there's one record that talks about how the union movement tried to come south during that time, and the race was the Achilles heel. They tried to get black and white people to fight for wages together, and the owners and the bosses would go over and say to certain white people, now, if they make the same thing that you make, then that makes them equal with you, despite color and white supremacy. So race was used as an Achilles heel, and it was sanctified in churches. The Redemption Movement. And their mantra, you can read Fana's book on Reconstruction or Black Reconstruction by W.B. Du Bois. Their mantra was, we got to redeem America and make it great again. Uh-oh. Why y'all act like y'all heard that? Y'all not living in the 1800s. I'm way back in the 19th century. Y'all acting like you've heard this somewhere. I don't have time to work through all these movements. Let me go to a second. Then there was a second movement following this World War II. The service had been desegregated. Black men and women once again had helped the nation fight against an enemy, just like black men and women, black men had helped fight the Union War. Second Reconstruction. Black, white, Latinos, and young people come together. 1954, the overturning Plessy versus Ferguson, the Brown decision. One of the Supreme Court judges then was a former Ku Klux Klan Grand Wizard. But he voted after Thurgood Marshall organized white and Jewish and black lawyers to argue the moral side of the law. He voted to overturn Plessy. There wasn't a single dissenting vote. Nobody expected Justice Warren to do this because Justice Warren had been so bad on the Chinese when he was in California. He had been hard on Chinese Americans and immigrants. But Thurgood, with those black and white lawyers, standing on the dissent of Justice Harlan. Because by Justice Harlan dissenting in 1896, he gave Charles Hamilton Houston a legal foundation upon which to build. Charles Hamilton Houston then went to the law school at Howard and said, I'm going to create social engineers. And I'm going to use the dissent of a white Kentuckian to build a case against white supremacy. 1954, Brown versus Board of Education passes, and the first riots were in New York. Y'all didn't hear what I just said. when Brown said call for the desegregation, the first riots and the first against it were not in the South. It went in the North. Then the next year, Emmett Till gets killed. On August 28th, 1963. By the way, parenthesis. When did Dr. King do the March on Washington? August 28th, 1963. When did President Barack Obama accept the presidential nomination of the Democratic Party? August 28th. But August 28th originally was the date of Emmett Till's death. And he's killed as a backlash to Brown. And then Rosa Parks sees his body like everybody because his mama, Mamie, decides to be a prophet. She says, if you kill him, you're going to look at him. And she refuses to close that casket and makes the whole world see what racism will do when it's allowed to go unchecked. Then Dr. Rosa Parks decides, I got to take on Jim Crow. She hadn't just started. She was down in Alabama investigating the rape of white women. And she wasn't some like little nice little easygoing woman. There's a book called The Radical Life of Rosa Parks. You ought to read it. She wouldn't even date a black man, didn't carry a gun on the date, because she said you didn't care nothing about her in the South because she knew how easy it was for black women to be raped. And the women in Selma had been, in Montgomery had been doing stuff long before King ever got there. In fact, the people at King's Church, sorry, my Baptist brother, the Baptists put the first pastor out because he was radical. Brought King in because they thought he'd be easy since he had a PhD. Then King later on gets put out of his denomination. That's how you got the progressive Baptist denomination. Don't mess with me. Don't you let everybody tell you that they stood with him while he was living. Everybody stands with a prophet when he's dead. Rosa Parks sits down. King stands up. And don't think that it just happened. It was long in the plan. See, my brother said he's right. Movements are born. But you got to make sure there's a birth canal. Movements are born, but you better make sure there's some intercourse somewhere. And they have been having social justice intercourse for a long time. Huh? If you think that Rosa Parks sat down and then they ran off 30,000 flyers on that old machine, those women had those flyers ready to go before Rosa ever sat down. And y'all don't believe it? How many of y'all know that's married? Your wife got some stuff you don't know nothing about. Mine does. One day I was around the house and we ran out of money. And she, for about a day, she said, I don't know where we're going to get the money from. I don't know where she's going to get the money from. And then on the second day, she said, well, I got $1,000. I said, what? She said, I always keep something in case you get crazy. I keep something. Those women had been planning, but they were waiting for the right leader and the right voice and the right timing. Other people had sat down on the bus, priming the pump. They sit down, the movement stands up. We get the second Reconstruction. And what happened? The language is not political, it's moral. In the streets, in the pulpits, from jails, they talk about moral issues. Presidents, senators, legislators, governors, editors, poets, all begin to talk about the moral urgency. Second Reconstruction, what do we see? The desegregation of schools, Medicaid, Medicare, the expansion of Social Security, including women and minorities, labor unions began to be stronger. We got the Office of Economic Opportunity, the War on Poverty, the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, increasing the minimum wage, all of this because of fusion moral politics. Blacks and whites and young people and Catholics and Jews and Muslims coming together. And then there's a backlash. Listen to me now. The extremists began to revolt. Movements begin to fuse. Dr. King goes to Riverside 50 years ago, April the 4th, and fuses racism, the movement against classism, the movement against militarism, all as one movement. calls for a poor people's march. After he preaches the sermon at Riverside, 150 papers denounce him. The NAACP writes a resolution against the unions come out against him because he takes on militarism and racism, and they say you just need to be a civil rights leader. But Dr. King says all this injustice is interrelated. They pull his open invitation to the White House. Some black people began to say his days are over. He calls for the Poor People's March in December 4th, 1967. He's dead exact to the date that he preached at Riverside 1 year later. And the sermon he was going to preach, he sent it home. He had preached it before, but he sent it home to be put. You know how in the Baptist church they put the sermon out on the sign? And the title of it was, America is Going to Hell. And it was going to use the parable of Lazarus and Dives. And she said, America's going to hell if she does not face her triple evils of racism, classism, and militarism. But right in the middle of that, a campaign starts. First, it uses violence and terror. Swanner, Chain, and Goodman are killed. Black and white people are killed, and to try to stop. And then the Southern strategy, the backlash, actually, the violence actually brings people in. 63, think about what happens. George Wallace gets up in February, segregation yesterday, today, and tomorrow. By the end of the year, Mega is dead. Four girls in the Baptist church are dead, and the president is dead. But then people who have been on the fence start saying, this is going too far. So violence begins to actually build the movement. Blood becomes the fertilizer and the seed of the movement. So they got to find out a new way. So begin to attack black leaders. Tax cuts start being the name of the game. They start saying that the Voting Rights Act is an attack on states' rights. Civil Rights Act is an attack on states' rights. Then Kevin Nixon decides to run for president, and his advisor, Kevin Phillips, says to him, listen, I can tell you how to win. This is how you're going to win. You got to find out a way to say what George Wallace says without sounding like George Wallace. He said, the secret to the American politics is knowing who hates who and to engage in the politics of otherism. Help make people start blaming the Latino other, blaming the black other, blaming other people for their problems. He said, if you do this Southern strategy and you learn code words to talk race, you can make the Republican Party the party of white people in the South. You can make Democratic Party the party of black people. You can win all 13 of the former Confederate states. And if you do it right, you can win the suburbs in the North, where there's a lot of racial tension, and you can win Rust Belt and the Wheat Belt. And if you just hold on to the South, the 13 states from Virginia to Texas, you win 171 electoral votes, which means you only need 99 from the other 37 states. And you can control 26 members in the United States Senate, which means you only need 25 from the other 37 states. And you can control 30% of the House of Representatives, which means you only need 20% from the other 37 states. And if you do this right, you can even play this game up north and pit communities up north and resegregate up north and get people to see that other people are their problem. So Wallace, he said, you got to read the speech that Wallace preached in Madison Square Garden, where Mark Wallace said, if you read that speech, I don't have time to take you through it, it sounds almost verbatim like Trump's speech. Go read it. Go Google it tonight. Everything he says, the othering, the speaking out against the corruption and the anti-elitism, anti-movement, anti-women, even where he says, get him out of here, somebody ought to knock him out with his long hair, that's in that speech. The counterculture, law and order, building up the military. Even Wallace, a racist, dared to say, don't worry about the unions, I'll get them. Because I'm going to find a way to make white workers think that black workers are their problem. He said, don't even worry about the blacks, I'll get some of them. Because some of them, what he was really saying is the racism is so they become so beaten up and internalized by racism that they end up supporting racism and looking black as midnight, but they right there supporting racism. You know that's possible, right? Racism is not just something that somebody white. You can have a white friend that's anti-racist and black folk that are pro-racist. Wallace loses, but they say he becomes the greatest loser of all time because he teaches Kevin Phillips and Nixon how to use this language. So they go back and they write a strategy. And the strategy says the new code word for the Southern strategy is tax cuts, entitlement reform, states' rights, and undermining government overreach. Said all this stuff sound. And then Lee Atwater, before he died, he did a little tape. You can Google this too. And he said, listen, none of that stuff sounds racist. But it is. Because when the policies that come out of that hurt black people more than white people, but it makes many white people think that black and brown people are their problem. And guess what the goal of the Southern strategy? Got to take back America and make it great again. So see, if you don't do an analysis, Neil Painter, who's over here at Princeton, says you got to understand if there was no Obama, there'd never been a Trump. She said what we are experiencing is not something new. It is as American as apple pie. It is the call and response that is woven and into the fabric of the American culture. You have racial progress and the progression of racism happening at the same time. It's not new. People say, Lord God, we got Bannon in the White House, a white supremacist. Well, there was a governor from New Jersey. No, a president of a college from New Jersey, who became president of these United States, named Woodrow Wilson. 100 years ago, exact to the date, he brought Birth of a Nation into the Oval Office, which was a racist movie that highlighted and uplifted the Klan and put down the Reconstruction movement. This is not something strange in America. Seeing once again is when America succumbs, too much of America, to rejecting statesmanship for slick performance. We reject real answers for lies and propaganda. And when we reject deep moral values of justice for the heresy of white evangelicalism. We reject an objective media for a media circus. And we reject dealing with racism for fear and the normalization of mean spirit. So early Wednesday morning after running a campaign that was even enthusiastically endorsed by the Klan, Donald Trump thanked his supporters for the victory and promised to be a president for all Americans. It was a shock to almost every pollster and every political pundit. His victory has been heralded as an unprecedented political upheaval. But the reactionary wave that swept across America last Tuesday in November, I wrote this back in November, is not an anomaly. Now, it's not the only side of America, but it is America. It is an all too familiar pattern of reconstruction and then reclamation, taking the country back, making it great has nothing to do with helping people. It has something to do with racist ideology. Anybody who watched The Return, you saw that red band from my state all the way around and then across the Wheat Belt, the Rust Belt, then picked off some places up in the Midwest. Trump, joins a long line of white men. There's a long line who have leveraged hate and leveraged this racist base to get to the White House.
So we got to know how we got here. First of all, this history, I know I'm too long, but give me a minute. Since y'all want to build a movement. How did we get here? Secondly, you got to know what the most undertold story in this election was. And that is that long before the Russians hacked, the American political process was already hacked by racism and voter suppression. Let me tell you. And this is why in the Moral Monday movement, if y'all are modeling it off in North Carolina, no politician can ever stand on the stage on a Moral Monday rally, even our friends. Because preachers, if you're going to build a moral movement, you're going to have to cut loose some of your political friends. It's not that you hate them, but you got to build a different kind of stage. They don't get the remarks. They don't get to do anything. They need to listen. Because let me tell you, the most underreported story of 2016 was that America experienced its first federal election in a half a century without the full protections of the Voting Rights Act. And think about it, you haven't heard any stories on that. You haven't heard Democrats talk about that. Now, don't miss, I didn't say we don't know how to vote tomorrow, Monday. I'm going to get to that later. But you first got to call everybody. Tomorrow means you're going to call everybody to accountability. We had 25 debates in the presidential and primary and the regular election, and not 1 hour on voter suppression. Not 1 hour, Democrat or Republican, Bernie, Hillary, Bush, Trump, none of them talked about what would they restore the Voting Rights Act. I just left Selma. 52 years ago, they bled on that bridge. And 52 years later, what they bled for, we don't have. And if that was going on in any other country, people would be outraged and in the street. We have less voting rights protection today in America than we had August 6, 1965. Because the voting rights was gutted, and when it was Section 4 was gutted, it nullified Section 5, which is called pre-clearance. And the reason you all in the North need to be concerned about is because of that Southern strategy. You can't have a Southern strategy if you have preclearance that keeps these Southern legislatures and others from passing voter suppression. But without it, they can pass voter suppression. They can engage in racialized redistricting. It takes 2 or 3 years to overcome it in the courts. By that time, they're already elected to the Congress and to the State House, and they're voting against the very kind of issue that CWA and other groups care about. So if you are concerned about America, New Jersey, you got to be concerned about North Carolina and Alabama, Georgia, and Mississippi. I'm trying to teach. And I'm telling you, preachers and rabbis and imams, I got kicked out of church Sunday morning. Negro done got too polite in church. What am I talking about here? We were at Brown Chapel AME Church that was the hospital for the movement, where the blood is still stained in the hardwood there, where Miss Boynton was bled and John Lewis bled. Where we were, and I had just spoken on, if you know history, you can't stand for hypocrisy. And I talked about how wrong it was of us, I don't blame them, us, to have a bloody Sunday remembrance and then invite Congress people to speak who are fighting against voting rights. Come here, somebody, in the name of being polite. You better remember the Jesus of Holy Week, who the first Monday turned over the tables in the temple. Is this not the fast that I require? And so they had the Secretary of State to get up and start giving remarks after me. And he was doing all right at first, which is why you got to watch that. I come here, brothers and sisters, as one of your brothers in Christ. You better keep them ears open, because the Bible tell you, a whole lot of folks say, Lord, Lord, but they're, her heart is far from it. And as he started talking, he started justifying photo ID and other voter suppression as the result, what came out of the civil rights movement, that those laws of voter suppression, in essence, were the blessings of the civil rights movement in Brown Chapel. Now that's some nerve, but the nerve is who invited him. And so after he went a little while, I decided, don't y'all have apostles in your non-denominational group? Okay, I can talk to you because they may not understand that. See, us Pentecostals, I'm part Baptist, part congregation, but us Pentecostal folk, we read 1 Corinthians 14 because every now and then we get folk speaking in tongue, but it ain't the tongue of God, and folk want to stand up and prophesy. So 1 Corinthians 14 says you can prophesy. You can get up, you can stand up, but then the senior prophet in the house must stand up and test what you are saying. And if it's wrong, call it, because you might think that's the Holy Ghost, and it might be heartburn from them pig feet you ate last night. That's got, Lord help.
Preach. Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Huh?
Yes, sir.
Huh?
Yeah.
So, I wasn't trying to be arrogant, but the Holy Ghost got on me and made me stand up and hold my hand. And I said, Mr. Secretary of State, with all due respect, you're lying. And you can't come in here and lie like that in the house of God. And the pastor said, be polite, Rembo. I said, he ain't being polite. And the spirit in me right now, Shakata the Boso, Hasheda the Boso, ain't saying be polite neither. I'm here to tell you, pastors and preachers, if you want to keep having polite church, don't get in this movement. Don't lie to your people. Don't have any friends politically that are more important than God's standards of justice. Most underreported story. We've had 22 states since 2010 that have passed voter suppression laws. And that wasn't taken up by Democrats or Republicans. Why? Because Democrats too often don't know how to talk about race, and Republicans talk about it all wrong. And neither one of them will ask the people who know. Because you know what? We had the president that could have helped us with race, but they shut him down and wouldn't even let him talk about race. The very President Obama that could have helped us, anytime he began to talk about race. And you know what? Those states that have had voter suppression controlled 254 electoral votes. And all of those states that have voter suppression, from trying to end same-day registration, early voting, not ain't just about photo ID. It's about closing in Alabama. They closed. They said you can have photo ID, get it at the Department of Motor Vehicles, then closed all the Department of Motor Vehicles in the black community. And that was the guy standing in that pulpit who closed them. Flipping precincts around, you don't know where to find them. Y'all have that right up here, right? And the states, 11 and 12 of the states with the highest Hispanic and black populations, have all had voter suppression since 2010, and since 2013, the Shelby decision, and since the election of President Obama, there's been an unprecedented attack on voting rights, which is a part of a backlash trying to stop a third Reconstruction, because what feared people who are extremists was not President Obama. He wasn't what feared him. It was the electorate that elected him, black, white, Latino, young, old, Republican, Democrat, gay, straight. And the fact that he broke through the solid South. He won in North Carolina. He won in Virginia. South Carolina took him over. He won in Florida. And Georgia and Texas are now on the radar. And if you start winning there and then hook up with a New Jersey and a Pennsylvania and then maybe an Ohio, it's over. Extremists can't win. And then not only that, extremists aren't just after the president, because they know the president can only sign executive orders to get a bill out you control the Congress. They are counting, my brothers and sisters. And a moral movement has to understand that you can't focus on just the president's election. I don't know if you know it, but there were 868 fewer voting places in the black community this past election year than there were in 2012. That's what hacked the system. Hundreds of thousands of black voters were suppressed, even in places like Wisconsin, But Trump only won by 20,000 votes. 868. Ari Berman did his nation report. And you haven't heard that, have you? You haven't heard us talking about that. We keep talking about the Russian hack. What about the racist hack? And it's not just about black voters. Remember how I started? Fusion. See, if you suppress the black vote, you undermine the ability of black and white and Latino people, Sister Baker, to form together. So let me show you how pretty fusion is. Come here, Sister Baker. I ain't being color struck. Come here. See, this is fusion. Ain't nobody being color struck neither. I'm just talking about what I'm talking about. Can't y'all tell we were fused? Y'all know we got a little Swahili in us and a little European in us. I'm not trying to say fusion. I'm just teasing. But fusion. And that's the fear. So it wasn't Obama. It was the ability to bring together a room that looks like that room out there. This is the fear right here. And the fear is if you can get this room into State House and this room into Congress and this room, then this room changes. How did we get here? Got here because of the way we saw race also operate, not only in voting, but the way in which we saw white privilege happen and the media put up with it. You got to know how you got here, you're going to have a resistance. Because you're going to have to, sometimes, y'all going to have a moral resistance movement in New Jersey, you're going to have meetings with your editorial boards. Because they ain't going to understand what you do. The first time you get together, they're going to say, we're a bunch of liberals. You have to, we're not liberal, we're not conservative. Not left, we're right. We're moral agents. We saw white privilege happen right in front of our face, and immediately didn't know how to do it. How do we talk about white privilege? All those lies Donald Trump told. That's white privilege. You know, Obama wouldn't have been able to think those lies. Y'all come on, help me, somebody. Some of the stuff Trump said, can you imagine Obama even thinking about saying John McCain wasn't a war veteran? Can you even think about Obama saying, I ain't gonna give you my tax return? I say do it, just think about it. Could you even see Obama starting his campaign saying, I'm gonna build a wall between us and Canada? Can you imagine President Obama getting up and saying, I'm just smart. I'm just smarter than anybody. Can you imagine that they would have said, that uppity, what in the world wrong with him? Am I right? Shoot, grabbing another. Obama couldn't even talk about grabbing Michelle, let alone grabbing another woman. Good God from Zion. That's why. Serious. I'm sick. Y'all remember that time they did the fist bump? That's all they had to do, just touch in public. Oh, they Muslims. Oh, Lord. You know, Michelle couldn't even put her thing on her shoulder. That's white privilege, y'all. That's when we talk. That's when you allow to just get away with stuff. Right in people's face. And you got to understand, though, the third thing about this race. See, racism doesn't sound like racism today. Edward, you ever get this? This ought to be a reading assignment for this movement. Eduardo Bonita Silva wrote a book called Racism Without Races. Y'all better read that book before you go to jail. Oh, by the way, I mean, y'all are ready, and if necessary, preachers, because you're going to have to leave now. Y'all the ones said y'all want tomorrow resistance. He says in his book, he says, many people say we don't have a race problem because we don't have any races. In other words, there's folk normally won't sound like racists. He said, instead, they blow dog whistles. Now, you know, a dog whistle is only heard by dogs. That's the point of it. I could get right up here right now and blow a dog whistle, and you wouldn't hear it, but the dogs would hear it. And there are certain political dog whistles. You don't think like that, so you don't hear it, but they hear it. Like when you call the president unfit, that's a dog whistle. Juvenile, that's what they call slaves. They were juvenile, so we got to take care of them. When you stand on the congressional floor and say, you are a liar. Watch, you missed it. Not you are a liar. different point. You are a lion. Huh? You got the, see, I went by the dog pound. I said, y'all teach me. I got a guy that works with me who used to be Strom Thurmond's assistant. He knows what the dog whistle sound like. I got another guy that marched with me whose granddaddy and daddy were in the Ku Klux Klan. And when you talk to folk that know the dogs, then they can help your ears. Huh? It's the same thing that happened on Pentecost. Not only did they speak in tongues, but they heard. And we better make sure if we're going to get out here, you know what you're hearing. Because people can come right in your church and level dog whistle. And then they talk, and then Democrats miss it so many times. Because when Democrats want to talk about racism, they talk about David Duke. We already know he's a racist. We don't want to talk about the Klan. That's not what racism really is anyway. Racism is systemic racism. When you are able to take your policies and implement them into public policy. And so what America's got to have is a grown-up conversation about race. We've had too many little silly conversations about race. Donald Trump was endorsed by David Duke. He could have paid David Duke to do that just to get us thinking the wrong thing. That wasn't what we should have been asking about race. Here's the race question. Since the census say that there are 18.9 million whites who are poor, which is 8 million more poor whites than black. 5 million more poor whites than Latinos. And 10 of the poorest 12 states are states that are majority white in their voting population who continue to elect candidates who vote against the very programs that help poor folk. What is it that trumps common sense? Now that's race question. And I'm not talking about the people so much, but I'm talking about what is it that these politicians are sowing? What brew are they mixing up? And then poisoning, you see, the democratic system in such that people will vote against their own self-interest. What is it when you need food stamps and you vote against people who have it? Now, but don't laugh, don't blame them. I'm saying, how can you trick somebody? You see, what is it? Did you say that, well, you're poor, but at least you're white? Because that used to be that was the language of the Southern strategy. What is it? What is it that makes you vote for somebody that tells you up front, you're poor and working, and they tell you they're gonna stand with the unions and end TPP. So you vote for them, but you miss when they said they don't even agree with a living wage. They think the minimum wage is too high. So what is it that makes you vote for somebody who's a failed businessman and make you think that you can trust him? In fact, if you couldn't trust him with birtherism, you can't trust him with your wages. Because you scratch a racist, you're going to find a thief. There are 400 families in America that make an average of $97,000 an hour. Now we got people being locked up who are fighting for 15 in a union. What is it? We need a grown-up conversation. What is it in the South and in many of these places across the country now where you have the most uninsured people who have voted for politicians that don't take their health care? What kind of poison, what kind of mythology are these politicians selling when they talk to these folk by themselves that make them vote against their own self-interest? Two-thirds of the people that voted, they said two-thirds of a certain group of people that voted for Trump getting ready to lose their health. And I'm not saying this so we be mad, because there's some problem with us too now. So I'm coming around that being too. But the point is, we have to have a movement that can expose, help people not be captured by this mythology. We've got to have a movement that is an antidote to the poison that's been injected into the veins of our democracy. That's as old as this democracy. What is it? What is it that causes people to vote? So
carnalize just as much. Trump can't do anything until the Congress passes the deal. I'm beginning to think that a lot of his tweeting is distraction.
Well, watch this. While we were watching the tweets, they passed a bill in the Congress and he signed it that allows mentally ill people to get guns. What is it? His own preacher, the preacher for his inauguration, lied. Pastor Scott, the black boy he had, lied. Lied so much, Joy Reid put him off. She did. Kellyanne can lie and she don't breathe. That woman talks, she talks so long she don't breathe. They lied the other day to black college presidents. But if we had this analysis, we would have known that you never go meet with somebody when you're not clear about the demand. And if they don't give you the demand, when you come out, you hold your own press conference. And what you do when folk want to take your picture, you say, no, picture after. After I gets what I want. But the guy that preached his inaugural sermon lied. He told President Trump before he put his hand on the Bible that God endorsed walls. Yes, he did. I read, Doc. The worst thing in the world could have happened for me was Google, because I Google everything. I already ran to the library. See, because the worst thing you can do is be loud and wrong. That's the other thing I want to tell you, preacher. If you're going to be loud, make sure you got a group of scholars that are footnoting everything you say. But the worst thing you can do is get up here and quote statistics that aren't right. He told him that. He said, God is a wall builder. No, God. And he used Nehemiah, which it had no context, claimed to be Christian. And I know I read somewhere where the Lord tore down the middle wall. And that's the last thing. How we got here? We got here because of the heresy of white evangelicalism. And I'm calling it a heresy. I meant to say exactly what I said. Because it is heresy. It's a form of heresy. When you say, because in the Bible, there are 3,000 scriptures almost about justice and love and mercy and how you treat the least of these. And whether you're Christian, rabbi, Muslim, if all you're doing is hating on gay folk, you just really got a fantasy. That's what your problem is. That's all you got to preach about. Because there are 3,000 scriptures. How is it that you say so much about what God says so little and so little about what God says so much? And a lot of this stuff, they do it because they think, but they say we can get black folk because, you know, conservative, you know, we get something about people, they get all messed up with sex. I mean, that's how you got here, but you get all messed up. That's all you got to do is bring that issue up. Just like now, folk getting right quiet. What are you going to say? I ain't going to say nothing because, you know, I don't know why people want to be in so many other folks' business and somebody get in your business, you would put down Jesus and want to fight right now. And even the church tonight, them officers didn't tell me, ask me, say, now, before you go in there, who you been with? The usher didn't do no check on me. They said, come on in here. We get all hung up. On what's between God and people personally. And while we're getting hung up on that, we miss all this public sin. Huh? And people use these wedge issues. Watch this. Watch. Let me teach. I'm give me 10 minutes. I'm through. Watch this. How many of y'all heard about North Carolina? Y'all know where North Carolina is? Say South. Now, what's that bill they passed down there? I've been talking about. HB2. What's it called? What's it about? No, it ain't. Bamboozle, hoodwink, run amok. That's Malcolm, if y'all didn't know. HB2 is, they call it the bathroom bill to trip us up. And they say it's about transgender people being able to go in bathrooms and protecting little girls and little boys. When in fact, there's no statistic of transgender folk. I mean, a lot about straight people doing it, but no statistic. Now, first of all, let me teach this so you can understand how this mess works. They raised that bill up right before an election to stir up that so-called white evangelical vote, right? And to get people, Lord, they letting their folk going in the bathroom. Where do you think they've been going? You don't know who transgender in here. You really don't. Because if they transgender, they've been transformed. Secondly, how you going to police it? What, you going to have a pee patrol? I'm being serious. What, you going to have a policeman in the bathroom? Okay, pull yourself. Now, Reverend, I'm telling you, I know you say your folk love you, but the minute you send one of them boys into them women bathroom and make them, it's going to be a fight up in Shiloh. I'm telling you right now, these black women going to knock you out and anybody else. And I'm talking about the straight ones. I ain't talking about nobody else. You mess around and go and let black folk go in the bathroom and somebody start asking you, what is you? When you already done waited too long to go to the bathroom anyway, and you trying to hurry up. And why y'all so mad with gay folk? Bayard Rustin was gay, who organized the March on Washington. But that ain't what the bill's about. Inside, the bill has 8 parts. That's the part they wanted in the media. The 5 parts of that bill has to do, first, denying, making it illegal for cities and counties to raise living wages. Oh. But see, they knew folk ain't going to read it, or they thought people weren't going to read it because they would be so caught up. Then the next part of the bill says, if you have a employment discrimination case, you can't bring it to state court. This affects heterosexual, veterans, disabled folks. And the third part of the bill, those are the 2 parts of it, and that's the other 5 parts of the bill. And then the bill, now they're trying to compromise and say, well, let us vote on the local level on people's civil rights. Well, what's going to happen if you start voting on people's civil rights? But the transgender gay piece is a scapegoat. It's the same way folk used to use black folk. No, here it is. It's the same way they call the Affordable Care Act Obamacare. You put Obama's name on it to make folk hate it because they thinking Obama. That's why the other day there was a video out there where a guy was talking about, I don't like Obamacare. I don't like Obamacare. Can't stand Obamacare. Got me saying, but what kind of health insurance you got? I got the Affordable Care Act, but I don't like Obamacare. You betcha. And they get all these so-called right evangelicals who are coming up claiming that this is all God. I'm an evangelical. I'm a theologically evangelical, conservative, liberal, theological, charismatic biblicist. In other words, I know Jesus for myself. That's what that means. And when you know Jesus for yourself, then you understand, you know heresy when you see it. And it's a heresy when all you're talking about is gay and prayer in the school and abortion and guns. And that's not what Jesus focused on. Read Isaiah 10, verses 1 through 3. Woe unto those who legislate evil and rob the poor of their rights and make women and children their prey. Read Isaiah 58 that my brother read. Read Micah 6, do justice, love mercy, walk humbly before the Lord. Read Jesus' first sermon, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me, for he hath anointed me to preach good news to the poor, recovery of sight to the blind, healing to the brokenhearted, and to declare the acceptable year of the Lord. Read Jesus' last sermon, when it's all over, and I judge New Jersey, and I judge North Carolina, and I judge America. When I was hungry, did you feed me? When I was naked, did you clothe me? When I was sick, did you help me? Ah, Jesus.
It's time. It's time for us to challenge
morally. You got all this lying. You got this thing now, they're attacking health care. A congressman the other day said, well, Jesus said, won't the poor be with you always. Jesus was a Jew. He was a Jewish boy. Jewish, help me if I'm wrong, Rabbi. When a Jewish brother quotes part of the scripture, he's thinking about the whole scripture. So when the poor won't be, that's part of Deuteronomy. But the rest of it says, and therefore, you should help the poor. You should not leave the poor alone. And it was talking to nations. Folk that claim they're Christian and now want to take away health care. If Jesus did anything, he set up free health clinics. He was the free health clinic without a premium, don't charge nothing. Man of the hour. Ask that woman with the issue of blood. Ask that blind man. Ask that lame. He didn't ask him, are you gay? He said, thou be healed. He didn't ask, well, are you white? Can you pay? He said, thou be healed. Free health clinics. Now you're going to cut health care. But even the health care is deeper than the health care. See, Steve Bannon told us, if you're going to build a movement, remember, you got to know what you're resisting. He said, we have come to office to deconstruct the administrative state. That's another way of saying we are going to undo all of these social programs we've disagreed with ever since Franklin Delano Roosevelt, so that we can take the taxes and put them back in the hands of the wealthy, greedy. Not the wealthy, the greedy wealthy, because there are a lot of wealthy folks that aren't greedy, but the greedy wealthy. That's why they want to go after Medicaid and then freeze it by 2020. That's why they want insurance companies to be able to charge the elderly five times more than young people. That's why they want to say if you break in your coverage and you have a pre-existing condition, you're going to have to pay 30% surcharge to the company. To the company. And that's why they want to give tax credits to help people buy insurance. If she was alive, I'd have to deport her over. But elect me now. I'm gonna get up and say, America, America, God shed his grace on thee, but I'm not going to have grace on Latinos. I'm going to put up Muslim bans the same way we used to have Jewish bans and Japanese bans. Just elect me. I'm gonna take your fear, your legitimate fear, and I'm going to point it at everybody. I'm going to point it at everybody. And they elect me, and I'm going to attack people because of their sexuality. In a country where we have a 14th Amendment that guarantees everybody equal protection under the law, regardless of your race, your color, or your sexuality. And then elect me, and I'll make sure to lie about voter fraud. And I won't say a thing about voter suppression. And after I've done all this to make everybody mad, when you can get elected at the state house or the Congress or the Senate or the presidency and being honest like that, we have a moral deficiency. And the truth is, if you want to save the heart and soul of this nation, you've got to have a moral revolution of values, a movement that refuses to stand down. We've got to start declaring voting rights and women's rights Doesn't even matter if they change the law. There's a higher law. There's a moral law. We've got to start saying that we know how to fix the heart of this country. We need pro-labor, anti-poverty, anti-racist policies that build up economic democracy through full employment, living wages, alleviation of despair and unemployment, a just transition away from fossil fuels, labor rights, affordable housing, direct cash transfers, and safety nets for the poor, and fair, just policies for immigrants. And we have to critique our policies around warmongering, where we put more money in bombs than we do in building up this humanity. We have to start saying that we need a moral movement that says we fight for equality in education by ensuring that every child receives a high-quality, well-funded, constitutional, diverse public education, as well as access to community college and university. We need a moral movement that says health care is a moral issue. Yes, we want to save the Affordable Care Act, but we want to go further. We want universal health care. If Canada can have it, we can have it. We want to expand Medicaid and access to Medicare and Social Security. And we want environmental protection, and we want to deal with climate change, because we recognize when we don't deal with health care and we don't deal with environmental injustice, people die, and we are a people of life. We are really pro-life, not just in the womb, but we're pro-life once you get here, pro-life when you get sick, pro-life when you need education, pro-life when you need a living wage. Then finally, we have to fix the heart of this nation by having a moral movement that declares we want fairness in the criminal justice system. We demand that we address the inequalities in our system that affects black people, brown people, and poor white people. We must build a moral movement all over the country, not a left or right movement, but a truth-telling movement. Because in truth, some things aren't about Democrat versus Republican. They are about what's right versus what's wrong. We have to have a movement that will not bow down in the face of arrogance. We need a movement that brings together people in states. We got to build it, because movements don't come from D.C. down. They come from Trenton up. They come from New Jersey up. We need a movement that isn't afraid to have black people and white people and Latinos and Christians and Muslims and Jews and Hindus and Sikh and people of faith and people who may not have a particular faith but who trust in a moral universe, and gay and straight and civil rights and labor, all in the same room fighting together. We need a moral fusion movement. That's the only thing, and that's the other side of America. Yes, America has this deep, dark reclamation side, but in every age, there's always arisen some moral defenders that have come together. That's the other side of America. Those that say we will not stand down. This must be our resolution. Like William Lloyd Garrison, the abolitionist, a white preacher who said, "I do not wish to think or speak in moderation. I will not retreat a single inch. I will be heard." Like Frederick Douglass, who said, "Where justice is denied, where poverty is enforced, where ignorance prevails, and where any one class is made to feel that society is an organized conspiracy to oppress, rob, and degrade them, neither persons nor property will be safe." We've got to stand up now. We can't stand down. Like Ella Baker said, poor and oppressed people have to come together and change this society. Like the poet Jan Cortez said, let us steel ourselves, because if we don't fight, if we don't resist, if we don't organize and unify and get power to control our own lives, then we will wear the exaggerated look of submission, the bizarre look of suicide, the dehumanized look of fear, and the decomposed look of repression. We have to get up and stand and fight. Like Dr. King said, we must have an eternal dissatisfaction with poverty, racism, materialism, and militarism. Like Jesus said in his day, we must say woe unto those who engage in religious practices, love to come to church, come to synagogue, come to mosque, but they leave undone the weightier matters of the law, which are love and justice and mercy and faith. Like Paul in the letter to Hebrews, we must declare we do not belong to those who shrink back and are destroyed, but we are those who persevere unto the salvation of the soul, because faith is the substance of things hoped for and the evidence of things not seen. And I come here not just to talk hyperboles and hypotheses. Down in North Carolina a few years ago, they had taken over our state legislature. They passed the worst voter suppression law and the worst redistricting law. They had a veto-proof legislature and an extremist governor. And folk thought we were going home and we were going to sit down. But instead, on April 29th, 2013, after they passed some of the worst laws we've seen in the country, 17 of us went in, 7 clergy, 10 people, 1 lady in a wheelchair with cerebral palsy, and young folk, and we began to pray and protest and raise issues about the issues, and for an hour they let us, and then they arrested us. They locked that woman up with the wheelchair, put in cerebral palsy. They put the cuffs on her. Her picture got in the paper. The next Monday, folk came, and we didn't even holler, ask them to come. We had already been fighting together for 7 years already before 2013 when Democrats were in office, because it's not moral if you don't fight everybody when they're wrong. You got to deal with everybody. So the next Monday, people came. By the time it was over, over 1,000 people, black, white, young, old, gay, straight, Muslim, Christian, Sikh, Hindus, Republicans, and Democrats had gone to jail more than any time in the history of a state company. But we also had a voting strategy, and we had a litigation strategy, and we had an organizing strategy, and we organized around the state, and we took a gathering like this outside the church. We started having church, synagogue, and mosque right in the state house. Yes, we did, right outside the state house. Every Monday, folk knew it was worship time. It was time to stand up for justice, time to stand up for what's right. And they voted against us. It didn't get better after the first rally. Ain't nobody scared of you if you rally one time. Oh, we did 14, and then we went around the state. Then the next year, we had a gathering of over 80,000 people. Then we had more, and we continued. And what started happening was the consciousness started changing of the people. When we started, only 40% believed in the Affordable Care Act. As we moved, 58%. And the change started happening. And as the consciousness changed, then the people voting started changing. And then after 3 years, we won our voting case. And then it all came together in this past year, 2016. Trump won North Carolina barely because they took away 154 voting sites in the black community. But they lost the governorship. They lost the auditor. They lost the secretary of state. They lost the attorney general. And a black man in the South won the Supreme Court by 350,000 votes in a southern state, making our state the only progressive southern state in the country. And the PPP poll analysis said if there hadn't been a moral movement that was willing to stand even when we looked like we were losing, y'all don't hear what I'm saying. They voted against us, but we stood, and we stood together. And so we got to have that kind of movement in New Jersey. We got to have it in South Carolina. We've got to have it in Pennsylvania. It's not a political movement. It's a third reconstruction movement. It's a transformation movement. It's a movement that says we will not stand down. And it's not even a movement that started with Maul Monday. Let me remind you that there was a time when 3 millennial boys, maybe one was in the Maul movement of his day, and the other was in the Black Lives movement of his day, and maybe the other one was in the Union movement his day. All I know is their slave names: Shadrach, Meshach, Meshach, and a bad Negro. Hey, Lord. And they faced a fella, and his name was Nebuchadnezzar. He was a narcissist, an egomaniac, who believed in his own press reports. He had his own Amarosa. They said everybody's got to bow down to Nebuchadnezzar. And they tell me that he loved to build towers. And nobody built towers like Nebuchadnezzar. And he loved to cover his towers in gold and make them shine. He loved to build them tall. And one day he decided to have an inauguration because he wanted everybody to bow down to the tower. If you want a job, bow down to the tower. If you want an ambassadorship, bow down to the tower. If you want a policy, bow down to the tower. And Nebuchadnezzar told those Hebrew boys that if they didn't bow down, he would throw them into fire. But what he did not know is that those boys already had a fire down inside of them. They had refused to eat the king's meat. or drink the king's wine at Mar-a-Lago, Babylon. And then rather than get drunk on the wine of the world, they sung the songs of Zion. They knew the stories of Egypt. They had heard of what their people had done long before them. They didn't believe the press that the king was putting out. And they had a fire down in their soul. And they didn't bow down. Instead, they said, "Oh, king, we don't have to answer you. Because no matter how tall your towers are, we serve a God that sits high and he looks mighty low. We don't have to answer you. We already know our God can deliver. But even if he doesn't, bowing down is not an option." And because they didn't change, they changed the climate. The king threw them in the fire. But then he peeked in there and he saw them standing up. Is there anybody in here ready to stand up in the fire? Because when you stand up in the fire, there's a fourth one who will come and stand with you. And so I stopped by to tell you, I've read about the moral movements of history, and I see the moral movements of the Bible, and everywhere I read, there's one clear message. When there's a Nebuchadnezzar, when there's a Nebuchadnezzar and an egomaniac trying to get you to bow down, you've got to plant your feet and say, bowing down is not an option. You've got to understand that he wouldn't be trying to get you to bow if he didn't know how strong you were if you stand. We may be headed into some fiery times. I don't have a false prophecy. It may get rough. It's probably going to get hot. They're probably going to do some more ugly stuff. But is there anybody in New Jersey that will declare, bowing down is not an option? Turning back is not an option. Looking down is not an option. Standing down is not an option. We've got to stand up. If I was home in my country church, I'd say, slap your neighbor a high five and tell them, standing up is our mission. Because standing down is not an option. One day I'm gonna bow, but not now. One day I'll bow when every heel is made low, and the rough places are made smooth, and the crooked places are made straight. I'll bow then when the sky rolls back and I see him for myself. I'll bow then when everything is all right and the glory of the Lord is revealed. I'll bow then. But until then, what do you do when you've done all you can and it seems like it's never enough? You just stand. Look at your neighbor and say, neighbor, give me your hand. You can't go down now. You can't shut up now. You can't fall down now. Standing down is not an option. Do I have a witness? Do I have a witness? Do I have a witness? Say yeah. Say yeah. Say yeah. Turn to your neighbor and say, neighbor, we didn't elect a God. We elected a man. God is still on the throne. Standing down is not an option.
Hallelujah. Hallelujah. Every preacher that knows the time has come that we've got to stand up, if it means going to jail together, it means walking into some congressional offices. But standing down is not an option. In a few weeks, a call is going out. for preachers to come, rabbis and others, to Washington, D.C. the week of March 20th. Bring an impacted person with you who needs health care. We're going to walk into Ryan's office. They say you're not supposed to do that because it doesn't fit congressional decorum. We're hiding behind those walls and passing policies that would kill people. That doesn't fit God's decorum. Preacher, will you come? Think about it. Bring somebody in your church. There's a group of us that have decided if anybody dies in our church because of the lack of health care, we're not going to have a nice sermon and lie. We can like Mamie Till's mom, we're going to open the casket, bring the cameras in. That this is what it looks like when evil policies. It's time out. We don't have to be mean. We don't have to cuss. We don't have to use Molotov, but we got to stand in love. We got to stand in the old king. We don't have to answer you. You throw us in there. You can get the Russians to hack. You can suppress the vote, but you don't understand. This ain't the worst thing our people have ever seen. And the folks stood up in the face of mobs and lynch ropes and dogs and slavery. No way in the world standing down is even a consideration. It ain't even an option. There's some stuff y'all need to win in New Jersey. Try standing up. Not just meeting, not just sending emails. And Texas, but decide standing up. You let 100 or 500 pastors go into the New Jersey State Legislature, rabbis, and lay down until they pass bills that raise the wages of the people you keep asking to pay tithes. And then do it again the next week. And then do it again the next week. And watch done some change. Because when you stand up, you don't change the fire. You don't fire and change you. You change the fire. And in a sense, you can God trust you with his presence in the fire? You don't know till you go in it. The fourth man didn't stand up, didn't get there until they were in the fire. Who will stand? Preachers, if y'all would mind coming across, Rabbi, if you're going to be a leader, we're going to have training tomorrow. Rabbi, just come on down. This is serious business. Turn to your neighbor. Didn't look at the people. Just look at the folks. Grab a neighbor and say, somebody stood up for you. Tell them, say, I know you wish this wasn't happening in America. Tell them, say, I know you wish this wasn't the case. But it is. And let me drop something on you. And this is not a drug. God knows in heaven. I don't like what happened. But even if Hillary had won, poor people would still be poor. There'd still be millions of people. There'd still be voter suppression. We couldn't go home. We can have to stop. But the people of faith have got to stop electing folk and then going home and saying it's their job. Moral dissent. Moral discernment. Moral organizing is not the job of the elected person. It's always the job of those who are faithful to the moral arc of the universe. Everything that we celebrate today, Social Security, Civil Rights Act 64, Voting Rights Act 65, 100 years ago, folks said that was impossible. It was always when a few started standing and built a movement. And you find any progressive thing that has happened in this country where there weren't moral voices that undergirded the cry. It's time. It's time. If you know it's time, you got that hand just kind of squeezing. Come on, Brian.
After you're done all you can.
I just, come here, sir. Come here. I just want to find.
Oh,
What do you do when you've done all you can now? Seems like it's never enough. And what do you say?
Grab somebody's hand
when
in the
your
eye.
Friends turn away.
We're making a commitment
and you're
tonight.
Before
you can organize, before you can plan, you got to first decide to stand.
When you're done all
and not one day,
learn.
Not one rally, not
seems
one event.
Like it's never enough. Well,
you got to refuse
you just
to bow.
Stand when there's nothing left to do. You just stand. Watch the Lord see
Hallelujah.
You through. It's after you've done all you can. You just stand.
Let's see if we can do a little of that chorus.